Can you sing that in church? I'm not too certain. Yeah, a lot of you first-timers are thinking the same thing. Welcome, by the way, if you're a first-time guest. My name is Chris Zarbaugh, and I'm the teaching pastor here at Clinton Township, and one of them on the staff here. And just like Danny said, I want to champion that today's topic is pretty intense. And probably one of the reasons why is because there's this duality of casualness versus, you know, this heaviness that comes with this addiction. And if you're just joining us for the first time, the reason why we're calling this series Crave is because we're talking about our inner cravings of our soul. Some of it's just destructive habits, but some of it's true addiction. And there's something inside of us that says, you know, I just can't say no to these things. And so what happens when things become destructive in our lives? What happens when we give in to the power and consequence and continue to perform these destructive habits in our lives of whatever it is? And so today is a pretty serious day. On the lighter side of things, if you're here for the blessing of the bikes, I appreciate you being here today. We have some riders here today. Can I hear you if you're here? You're a rider? Okay, very good. Very good. Just to let you guys know that there was absolutely no correlation between the alcohol subject and the blessing of the bikes. It just kind of fell on that day. So whatever. Truly it did. But anyway, we're glad that you're here. We're going to do that 10 minutes after the service out here and provide free White Castles, because we all know that's really healthy coming off the food week that we just did. But I'm all game for it. But as we get into this message, here's the deal. We have a psychologist he volunteers his time on staff, Jack Wilson. You heard from him before in this series, but he has been a counselor for 30 years and has his PhD mostly counseling people with destructive habits dealing around alcohol. And he's helped us out on staff so much. And so for the first part of the message, you're going to hear from him with Dave Wilson, one of our teaching pastors. But before we hear from that, I'm going to come up and wrap up the deal. But I want to read for you this speech. It's very short, but it was given by Noah S. Soggy Sweat Jr., whatever that is. He's a former Mississippi legislator. He's a lawyer and a judge. And he gave this speech in 1952 when they were considering making liquor legal. This is what he says. "My friends, I have not intended to discuss this controversial subject at this particular time. However, I want you to know that I do not shun controversy. On the contrary, I will take a stand on any issue at any time, regardless of how fraught with controversy it might be. You have asked me how I feel about whiskey. All right, here is how I feel about whiskey. If when you say whiskey, you mean the devil's brew, the poison Scrooge, the bloody monster that defiles innocence, dethrones reason, destroys the home, creates misery and poverty, yea, literally takes the bread from children's mouths. If you mean the evil drink that topples the Christian man and the woman from the pinnacle of righteous, gracious living into the bottomless pit of degradation and despair and shame and helplessness and hopelessness, then certainly I am against it. But if when you say whiskey, you mean the oil of conversation, the philosophic wine and the ale that is consumed when good fellows get together, that puts a song in their hearts and the laughter on their lips and the warm glow of contentment in their eyes, if you mean the Christmas cheer, if you mean the stimulating drink that puts the spring in the old gentleman's steps on a frosty, crispy morning, if you mean the drink which enables a man to magnify his joy and happiness and to forget, if only for a little while, life's great tragedies and heartaches and sorrows, if you mean the drink that sells and pours revenue into treasuries untold with millions of dollars, which are used to provide tender care for our little crippled children, our blind, our deaf, our pitiful, aged, and infirm, to build highways and hospitals and schools, then certainly I am for it. This is my stand, and I will not compromise." And isn't it true that that really is the tension that we live in, and we have questions about what does the Bible say about this, and what is relevant, and how much is too much, and what's out of control, and really, truly, what stance should I take, or what should I know what to do? And so the duality of this is going to be addressed. And so sit back and listen to what Jack and Dave have to talk about, and then we'll come up and look at the scriptures from there.
That speech really gets at the conflict, the controversy that our society has when it comes to alcohol. Is it appropriate to drink it, good and bad? And that's what we're tackling today. It's a pretty big topic and something I really think is going to be a great, great weekend. And to do that, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to interview a friend of mine, Jack Wilson, who is a PhD in counseling psychology. He's taught in this area and trained in this area of substance abuse for over 30 years. And every time I sit with Jack, and you're going to find the same thing today, there's just wisdom from his life and from his training and teaching. So we decided to bring him in and say, let's talk about this issue of alcohol. So first question, Jack, would be this. You know the whiskey speech. You brought it to us. So there's that debate of good and bad. How do you look at this whole thing in alcohol in our society?
Yeah, that's the reason I really like that particular speech, because it does do such a good job of summing up, you know, all the ways of looking at alcohol and the ways our society looks at it. And I really believe both sides are correct. If you are a moderate user of alcohol, if you don't have a physiological predisposition where it becomes dangerous to you, I have no objections to appropriate use of alcohol. But we have to always be cognizant and aware that there are individuals out there for whom, because of a variety of different factors which we'll talk about, it's simply not safe for them to consume alcohol. But we don't want to just talk about the individual who has the problem with alcohol. We also want to make sure that we take a look at the impact that it has on their family, because this becomes a spiritual issue, a moral issue that has great impact on everybody around the person who is doing the drinking, all the way out to the larger society.
What are the stats? I mean, what kind of, you know, what's going on in our culture right now in regards to alcohol in families, individuals, whatever?
Well, what we know is the approximate percentage that most professionals are comfortable with is 15% of the population have serious issues when they consume alcohol. It's a little tricky, though. I said 15% of the population. But that doesn't address people who don't drink. There are a lot of people out there who don't drink, and they're not in our statistics in terms of problem drinkers. But what we do know is individuals, let's say from within that 15% who have difficulty with alcohol, 35% of them, fully 35% of them, would fit any definition of alcoholism that we could possibly come up with.
Now, how would you define an alcoholic?
Well, there's always been a lot of argument, and I even think it's a canard, about whether the alcoholism is a disease or is not. And I'm just going to say, yes, it is. I don't want to take a lot of time on that. But it is a disease, and it's a disease that is characterized by a loss of control. It's progressive, and if it continues through its progression, it's fatal. Let me give you an example. What I mean by that is society, much like the whiskey speech, we're confused. We have an image of an alcoholic as being the derelict, the skid row bum. That's not the typical alcoholic. Alcoholism exists on a continuum from an individual because of some predisposition is beginning to develop the disease, and that's where we want to step in. That's where we want to have an impact.
Which blows the myth, because the college guy who can drink everybody under the table is the stud. You're the man because you can hold more alcohol, and you're saying that guy or that gal is actually in more trouble than the guy who can't drink a beer or two.
Yeah. The other thing that we see is people who won't go or won't be involved in a social activity or an event unless alcohol is served. The guy that won't play on the slow pitch team, you know, or the girl that won't go to the party. Just think of all the things you've heard, you and Ann have sat in the room when you're doing premarital counseling, the debate over serving or not serving alcohol at the reception. Well, if we don't serve alcohol at the reception, my uncles won't come.
Exactly.
Okay. See the power, you know, that culture begins to exhibit and how normative it becomes. Well, whenever I hear those kinds of things, then as a professional, I start going, we better ask some more questions here, because it looks to me like we're beginning to move into the area of significant alcohol abuse.
Yeah. When does a person decide it would be safe for me or it would not be safe for me to even become a social drinker, maybe?
What I would say for you as an individual or for anybody listening to this, do your own family tree. Go back at least two or three generations and look around to see whether there have been some folks that the family referred to as problem drinkers, or Uncle Ned couldn't really handle his booze. Or, you know, and the closer it is to you, the more at risk you are of being in that 15% of people for whom alcohol can be a serious problem. So if one or more of your parents would be someone that you would think of that didn't handle alcohol well, created confusion in the family life because of it, then I would say that's a point at which you should be seriously considering the way you use alcohol.
Yeah.
Well, let's push that a little bit. What does that mean? Well, what that means is that if you have one or more parent who is an alcoholic, you have a 5 times higher probability of having the predisposition to this disease than someone who doesn't.
So I've heard you talk about the 3 P's. You just mentioned one of them. What are the other P's that you think of when you dig around your family tree?
Well, you when you're digging around and taking a look at things, you want to see what precipitates, you know, your drinking, and that's the culture that you grew up in. It's the advertising. It's the billions of dollars that we have in media. Frankly, I think most people in the room would agree the best and funniest TV ads, you know, are the alcohol ads. They do a great job. But that's all part of the precipitating thing in terms of that we as a culture say it's okay. We have some of the least restrictive laws as it relates to public drunkenness. We have some of the least restrictive laws as it comes to drunken driving. Most of the other countries in the world are nowhere near as tolerant. That's a precipitating issue. And then the next issue becomes the perpetuation of the issue. You know, are you going to continue doing it? And when we look at perpetuating, we come to another diagnostic category, which is extremely important, and it's really kind of the capstone category, and that's, do you continue drinking in spite of negative consequences? If you have had a couple of negative consequences and you cut way back, stop drinking, don't drink at all, become what we would call a moderate drinker, then that's something that you've made as a good judgment. But if you have something in your genetic makeup, then the likelihood is that you're going to continue drinking in spite of the negative consequences.
So, I mean, this whole series we're in called Crave, that would apply to any one of the craves we talked about, food, sex, today talking about alcohol. Why does a person, from your perspective, who has negative consequences with drinking or any of the others, continue to do it?
Your brain's actually changed. And your brain is set up in such a fashion or a condition that it craves the alcohol. And we refer to it as the point at which you tip over. And I can't tell you for any individual when that tip over point's going to come. I'm a very strong believer that many people are born alcoholic because they're 2 ounces, 3 ounces in the womb, and their mom has a beer every day. Whoops. That's a tremendous amount of alcohol. And if you have any element of precipitation in there, so many, many young people start their life that way.
Yeah. But as I look back on my past, it's like, okay, so I'm in college deciding to drink and realizing in myself this, what would you call it, this desire to not have 2 beers, to go to the third and the fourth. Every time I drank, it was never one. It was always like, let's go farther. But until I heard you talk about this, I never connected dots like predisposition. You know, my past, thinking almost every single night of my life from 5, 6, 7, 8 years old to 17, 18 years old, always seeing mom and dad with a glass of vodka or gin every night. So, you know, for someone like me, if I came into you and said, hey, Jack, do you think I should drink? What advice would you give a guy like me?
The advice that I would give you is to remember the Paisley song does a really good job of talking about the personality of alcohol. And the personality of alcohol is it's cunning, it's baffling, it's powerful, and it's infinitely patient. The fastest growing segment of people that fit the diagnosis of alcoholism today are people over the age of 55. And it's going up faster up in each age group beyond that. We have the two groups that we're most concerned about in terms of getting information out there, and that's the young, you know, and the folks over 55. So I know you're not over 55, but I would think with your family tree, it just is something that I would say, don't do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the amazing thing from in my story, and I'm guessing a lot of people this weekend, light bulbs are going on right now. You may have your schedule full of people coming in, but, you know, just connecting some of the dots, it's like I never was told this, never thought, okay, so I had an alcoholic mom and dad that would, you know, I'm like, I'm not them. Even though it split up our home, I'm not them. I can handle it. And so I made a decision based on just wise counsel to not have alcohol in my home. It just is like, duh. Now, I know there's some people probably sitting out there going, well, I didn't have alcoholic parents. I can handle it. What do you say to them? Maybe they can. Is that what you say? Or?
Well, I'd say to them, take a look at your life. Yeah. Is the consumption of alcohol getting in your way? Is it interfering? If it's getting in your way, if it's interfering, if it's causing problems in your marriage, if it's causing problems at work, then I would ask you to do a simple little thing. Now remember, simple and easy aren't synonyms, okay? But I'm going to ask you to do a simple little thing. Don't drink for 30 days.
At all?
At all. Oh. And as you make the decision to be free of alcohol for 30 days, take a look to see how you feel about that. Hmm. Okay? And if at the end of those that 30 days, talk to someone who has background or experience in the area, and you may come to the conclusion that, yeah, things are okay. Or you may come to the conclusion, I had a little bit of more of an issue here than I thought that I did.
Now talk about the person that's affected by alcohol in their home or in a friendship or a relationship at work, that they're not the one drinking, but they're living close in a relationship or, you know, some kind of relationship with somebody that is. What do they do? How do they make a difference? How do they help this person see? Can they? Or they just throw up their hands like this and say, there's nothing I can do?
The biggest thing that that I really want people to take home is that term hostage. It sounds almost brutal. Okay, but I want the people to take home the word hostage, and I want them to do an evaluation of themselves. Have they and the rest of the family become hostage to alcohol? And that's the first step. If you accept the fact that you truly are not in a relationship with this person, you're just simply hostage to their alcohol, that'll cause a mind change almost immediately. From there, then, there are a variety of different things. You know, our recovery groups here on Monday nights do a really good job of helping people whose lives have been made unmanageable because of somebody else's drinking. There's Al-Anon for people. Al-Anon's an amazing group that was actually started by the wife of the guy who created Alcoholics Anonymous because she wasn't real sure what to do once he got into recovery because she'd been codependent, co-alcoholic, whatever term you want to use, for so many years that she also had stopped growing and stopped maturing. So it's really important to spend time with people who've been down the road, you know, who've been there in front of you, and to get their wise counsel.
So that community aspect is huge. I mean, we've said it every week in this series, but hopefully people hear that, to go to a safe place where other people know the struggle and can share with you and go forward, hopefully, right?
Correct.
So many people that drink don't think they have a problem, so they're not willing to admit they have a problem. What do you do with a person like that, especially if that's somebody you're in a relationship with?
Well, let me just say one thing that, again, might be controversial, but I've been doing this for 30 years.
You're good at the controversial.
I've never met an alcoholic who didn't know they were an alcoholic. Mm. It's just that they haven't been willing to face it yet. It's just that they haven't been willing to turn it over.
Okay? So you're saying deep in their soul, they know there's a problem here.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah. But the personality of the hostage taker is so strong that it blocks them from doing anything about it. My experience is that people who are the low bottoms, the folks that are not at the physiological dependency level yet, which is not necessarily a synonym there, so I want to be careful. Yes, there are low bottoms that need to be detoxed. But the low bottoms seem to be willing to accept a recommendation or a suggestion that they go to an AA meeting. What a great place to start. If you think you're beginning to have issues and concerns with alcohol, AA is everywhere. Three meetings a day at least, you know, and places all over.
Yeah.
So if someone tells you they can't get to an AA meeting, whoops, sure they can.
Yeah.
They're everywhere. And what a wonderful place to start in terms of beginning to get an idea in terms of looking at life, you know, without alcohol. That's the part of it. The issue in terms of the family and the people who are concerned and affected, you asked me about the wife or the husband. You should hold that person accountable for their conduct. And if you are a wife or husband and you are committed in the sickness and health, and yet this is a disease, then I think that a very important step is some form of an intervention. Some form of bringing people together who can sit down with the individual and honestly say to that individual, this is the way your drinking is negatively affecting my life. You know, this is the way your drinking is getting in the way of us being able to move forward as a family. You know? And a variety of people can and should be involved. Most folks who talk about the recovery process will tell you that that hearing from their coworkers and their bosses was a much more powerful thing than hearing from members of their family.
Really?
You know, there are people out there now through the different services that are mentioned in the materials we're giving out who have intervention specialists on staff who can teach you how to do a beginning stage intervention who actually can come in and run an intervention in your home for you if it's something that you would prefer to have a professional do.
Yeah, because it sounds to the typical person pretty scary to think that I would confront my dad or my spouse without a little help. Like you said, with some skilled professionals or people at least have done it. Have you seen those done, some kind of intervention? Like you said, it's better to have just more than just family members there. Do you see success?
If there's a plan.
Really?
There has to be a plan. If I say to you, I'm concerned about your, you know, your use of alcohol, and I don't have a plan, I wasted your time and my time. I may even have raised the risk for you. So I have to be in a situation where, and that's where, you know, talking to an intervention specialist, I have to be in a situation where someone who is a recovering person can say, and as soon as this is over, I want you to go to this AA meeting with me. Or the intervention specialist can say, and this is the treatment program we're recommending for you. We already have the airplane ticket. You're on your way to wherever, you know, or I'll drive you there myself, or I want to take you to the emergency room to start the detoxing process, because there needs to be a plan right there so that the individual can see that it wasn't just smoke, because she's been told so often, stop drinking, stop drinking.
Yeah.
We want this to actually be an intervention.
Wow.
And the intervention needs to be honest, but you need to use common sense in the intervention. But you also have to have compassion, because I don't know anybody who wants to be an alcoholic. No 5-year-old or 15-year-old or 55-year-old said, "Oh, I think I'll wake up tomorrow and destroy my life." What a great idea!
Yeah.
No, so you have to. Sorry. I've seen this kill so many people. The compassion grows out of knowing that individual is lonely, they're isolated, and they really want help. And the compassion also operates along the line. There's good news. People by the tens of thousands gain control over this disease and go on to lead full, beautiful, balanced lives.
I've known Jack for about 3 years, and he serves as a mentor for me, and as a matter of fact, he's helped me through some pretty tough times. Thank you. And I'm talking about serious, real tough times. And all the times that I've met with him, he has never, ever broken down like that. As a matter of fact, for the 14 years he's been at Kensington, for every interview he's ever done, or every time he's talked to our staff or to Steve or to Dave and all the people he mentors on staff, he has never broken down in any interview. And later on, the interview went on, we had to edit it, but Dave asked him, he said, "What just happened there? Why did you stop there?" And he said a few things, but he said, number one, he says, "I saw the faces of the people over the years." I mean, you can imagine 30 years of meeting with people, extreme cases, most of them probably, but probably all the hope and desires that he has for those people to get better, you know, speaking hope and encouragement to those people. And then one after another, seeing all the tragedies and all the things that took place from that, and the people who have lost their lives physically and emotionally and spiritually and in all other sorts of ways. But then he also said, you know, and he said it at the end, that there is hope, because tens of thousands of people walk away and live healthy, balanced lives because he saw those people as well. And it's really interesting how this thing, this duality of alcoholism, is so familiar to all of us, because it's there. I mean, every time I go out, you know, with people who just, you know, aren't a part of this crowd, but just other venues, it's just there. Alcohol is just expected to be a part of the night. Matter of fact, some people won't even be a part of the night if alcohol is not even part of the night. And it's just casual, and then there's that whole gray area in between. And then there's the other side of things, and there's death and destruction. And it's just like, where does it end, and where does it begin, and what should we do about it? Many of you know my story, but I'll just tell you real quick. I grew up in a household. Mom and Dad were divorced when I was 10, and my family owned bars, and that's what they did. As a matter of fact, my mom has owned several bars, so consequently, I grew up in a bar. And so my mom was working three jobs to pay the rent. Being the youngest, I spent all my time at the bar. And so that's where I learned to play pool and darts and all that kind of stuff, which I will beat anybody at in here, bar none. But And so that's kind of was a part of my life. And so I've been around alcoholism, alcohol and then alcoholism too, all my life. My family, my mom, my grandfather, all my relatives, all my uncles, my brothers, attending AA, my mom never married but she dated a guy for 20 years, continual alcoholic. I can't even tell you the number of times when I've been pulled, toward that, just the memories of that. Because when I was 8 years old, I remember mixing drinks for the big socials, and there'd be hundreds of people there, and everybody was so impressed because I was 8 years old. I knew how to mix just about every single drink. So I was behind the bar doing that. I remember that I was the one that supplied all the liquor for all the high school and middle school, mostly middle school, actually, parties. And whenever the middle school wanted to party, I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, on the wrong side of the tracks, and that was the culture. And it's like, so I would collect all the money, and I would go into my grandfather's walk-in cooler, take all the liquor, supply it for the party illegally, and then, ashamedly, I would pocket the money and steal the liquor, because my grandfather didn't keep good books. And my brothers were in on that, and so we'd split it. He'd drive, and, he'd have a cut and all that kind of stuff. And that really was my upbringing. And so, like Jack said, I am predisposed to being an alcoholic. I have more of a tendency. I have five times greater chance, not only that, but the alcohol trace in my family history, to have that control my life. And that, consequently, was one of the very first things that I put away when I found, Christ. And not religion. I didn't find religion, okay? I found a personal, loving relationship with God, because religion is not the answer. Going to church is not the answer. Doing good is not the answer. I never knew that a relationship with Jesus Christ was even possible, and that all of that was, wrapped up into this word called Christianity, which was so distorted for me growing up. So I put that away, and because here's the thing. I realized that, younger, when I would drink to get drunk, it's like I was taking a gun and putting a loaded gun up to my head and didn't even know it. And so it's really dangerous for me, and it still continues to be something. And when I get relaxed about it, that is when I'm flirting with disaster. Last night I met with two ladies at the Troy campus during the Saturday service and talked with them, and these are two women that go to Kensington, who they're sisters. And they both married men who are just, if you have met these men in the past, you would immediately say these men are, good looking, successful, just normal, loving, great, great dads. And so here's what happened. They both married around the same time, but different times throughout their marriages, these two sisters found out at different times that their husbands had a problem with alcoholism. And when I heard their story, I just broke down just like Jack did, and I bawled like a baby. And the reason why is because their story is horrific, but you're not going to believe this, but both of their stories end with both their husbands, their lives ending because of alcohol. And so here's what I want to do is just kind of show you a picture of Mike and his two girls. These are the two girls that Mike leaves behind. And Mike passed away just back in 05, just a few years ago. And so Jean is his wife. And so last night, she threw together some words that I want to read to you. And she wrote actually a whole letter to alcohol. And I just want to read you just a couple sentences. She says, "To alcohol, you have destroyed my family. You have taken the man that I married nearly 10 years ago and turned him into a complete stranger, a cruel, mean, heartless stranger." Now, when you look at that picture, you don't see, a complete, mean, cruel stranger. I mean, he looks just like you and me. And that's really the issue with this thing we're talking about. You know, we need to get that whole, you know, wino on the side of the row with a paper bag image out of our heads, because that's not the case at all. I would say that the majority of people who struggle with this thing in their life, this destructive habit, are exactly like the people in this room. He can't focus on his two beautiful daughters. Alcohol, you have stolen that from him. You have stolen their father from them. They have never known a healthy father. You came into their lives and into our life and took all the normal, healthy bonds that exist in a family, and you drowned them. And for that, I completely feel hatred for you. When Mike passed away, he actually said on his deathbed to the other brother-in-law, Eugene, married to Mary, and said, I hope this will be a lesson to you so that you might turn from this disease. And you would think that would be enough, but just 6 weeks ago, Eugene died and left two boys behind. And here's a picture of the other sister and her family right here. And here's what she wrote. Because of the bottle, my boys only had their father for 8 and 10 years. Hang on. That's pretty rough. My boys only had their father for 8 and 10 years. Because of the bottle, I must raise these boys without their dad. These boys will never have a chance to learn how to be a man from their father, nor will they learn to cook, paint, fish, or garden from him. Because of the bottle, my boys don't have daddy at their baseball games, school events, band concerts. My boys had to grow up much faster than any child ever should. Because of the bottle, my boys were cheated out of the opportunity to witness a lifelong healthy relationship between a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, and their daddy and their mommy. Because of the bottle, he won't be there for school promotion, graduation, accomplishments, weddings, or babies. The world has lost and was cheated out of one of the most unique, talented, funny, compassionate, loving men God ever created. And then she says, because of the shame attached to that bottle, that man would not, could not, and did not get the help he needed soon enough. And I don't think that we realize the power of this disease, the power that comes with it. And you know what? I've been used to telling stories about my childhood, most of which would shock, but a lot of them are just funny. And that's just, you know, around alcohol, stories are just funny. But for every story that I have there, what I don't realize all the time, and what I don't always tell, is just about every single story that's hilarious. If I were to take all the main characters in all my stories of my life in the 37 years I've been on this earth, more than 60 to 70%, probably, just what comes to my mind, more of them, their lives have been completely destroyed. You know, that man that my mom dated for 20 years as a drunk, he was just a happy guy. I mean, he was the nicest guy you ever want to meet. You know, he used to sing Willie Nelson On the Road Again every time I met him. And you know, it was just like, he was just the happiest guy you'd ever want to meet. And then it was about 3 or 4 years when I realized he had a problem with drinking. And I says, well, I've never seen him drunk. And my mom says, no, you've never seen him sober. And it's true. And that's just the way he lived his life. But his life was ended when he came home from the bar. He had some drinks and he got in a car wreck and died. And my mom, you know, put him in the ground. And Mike Weary, a good friend of mine, lost his life on a motorcycle. Drinking too much, played Russian roulette. Not literally, I'm talking about, you know, figuratively. Just gambled the odds and would just ride when he was drinking and got in a car wreck. Went over a bridge and landed on the freeway below. Ended his life on his way over to my house. Good friend of mine, Chris Emerson, man, just a great person, friend of actually one of my brothers, was in Cleveland, laid down to look up at the stars on a railroad track, passed out, got run over by a train. I mean, I'm just surrounded with not only people that come to me to talk about this destruction in their lives, but just countless stories. I mean, for all the people who died physically, there's three times as many. There are three times as many who their marriages have been destroyed. You don't have to die physically in order for you, you know, to have destruction. There are men who lost their families and their lives, and they're estranged to their kids, and spiritually and emotionally, just absolutely, there's a wake of destruction when it comes to this disease. And what's really funny, it's not funny, haha, but it's funny, interesting, is that we don't seem to recognize when that turns. And the reason why is because the chains of addiction are too light to feel until they become too heavy to be broken. And it really is just like playing Russian roulette. If you've ever, you know, seen that on a movie, hopefully you've never played it. You put one bullet in, spin the chamber, and then you just pull the trigger. And it's amazing how that's really what we do in our lives, especially those of us who have a family tree. We're predisposed to having a struggle with this. I just want you to know that all through my life, I've completely made it a point to walk away from that and to not even be near it. There are some things where I'll just laugh about or whatever, but when it comes to this, I just won't go near it. But that's a personal choice. As singles director of Kensington, one of the biggest controversies that I had to deal with was, do we have alcohol at a small group meeting? And you know what? Every time I heard that, I had to take a stand for that in my ministry, and I would just say, gosh, I can't understand why you would come together for a church function and have that. Because I'm not against social drinking, so to speak, but you know what? Having a small group and not even knowing who's going to come, if it's an open group. I mean, not knowing the family tree, or that people may be five times likely to become an alcoholic, that we just hand like a loaded gun to people. I don't understand it. So I used to say, if it's a church-sponsored event, just don't even do it. Why do that? If you want to do it outside of a church-sponsored event with the same people, that's fine. And so, you know, we're not necessarily telling you to do that. We're just saying you need to think long and hard about that. So the question is, what does the Bible have to say? Well, let me just get this out of the way first. You know, the Bible does talk about wine. Jesus talked about the word wine more than he did about hell. Matter of fact, Jesus, his very first miracle, he turned the water into what? I've been told in my Baptist heritage that that wine, it really didn't mean wine, that it was like, you know, the water wasn't purified, so they had to mix it with grape juice. And many of you probably have been told that. And so the big debate is, was it really wine or wasn't it wine? Well, I did a study on the word wine, and I found out in the Greek, you know what it means? Wine. Yeah, it pretty much means wine. Yeah. And so the Bible talks all the way through it about there being wine. And so, matter of fact, even in the book of Timothy, it says, you know, to use wine for medicinal purposes. Okay, so I mean, it's in there. Okay, by the way, most people think medicinal purposes is a huge glass of wine a day. It's actually just a few ounces every, like, three times a week. It's not even every day. So people, when they say too much, how much is too much? I don't drink that much. That phrase is so vague. Okay, and people try to, you know, explain things away or rationalize them away. Just like this medicinal thing, you know. You may go home and say, whoo, medicinal, you know. It's not that way. It's not designed to be that way. Matter of fact, in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 18, Paul says this, do not be drunk with wine because it will destroy your life. Instead, let the Holy Spirit fill and control you. And so Paul simply addresses that which we already know, and that is you can take something and abuse it, and it become destruction in our lives. Just like food in itself is a good thing, or it's not a bad thing, but if it's abused, then the Bible says it's wrong to do that. And it talks about obesity, and it talks about different things in the Bible. It's the same thing with wine. So here's the thing we want to have you mark down. If you want to take out your program, you probably already wrote down, hopefully, the three P's that he mentioned. You want to write down three A's as action steps. Here's the first one, is awareness. The word awareness. You need to do a family tree. You need to go back and just think. And have you ever gone back and just said, you know, how is my family, you know, infected by this? Or what are the consequences of it? And then here's another question you need to ask. What is the legacy that I'm going to leave in the future? I talked to one guy before the first service that talked about, he says, thank God I had a chance to talk to my father on his deathbed. Because I wanted him to die. I hated him, but you know, he was an alcoholic and affected all us kids, and so thank goodness that we had a chance to talk right before. I'm thinking to myself, man, my story and your story are really different. I mean, yeah, I had a lot of heartache. My brothers would come home and literally beat us up when they were drunk. They would get us drunk and make us fight each other. I mean, there was a lot of heartache, you know, with AA, I mean, the whole thing in my family. The only difference is my story, thank goodness, ends fine. Because since the God factor has come into my family's life, every single one of my brothers, one by one, eventually turned their life over to God. And it's no longer a factor in our family. But hearing stories like that, I mean, I can name you 15 that I've heard this morning. And it's just unbelievable to hear the destruction that comes with the wake and the legacy. And you know what? Many people, here's what they think. They think, it's my decision. It's my choice, it's my life, and I'm going to do what I want to do. But what they don't realize is that for every time you make a decision about yourself, it doesn't only affect you. That is a selfish stance, because every time you are tempted, your family and friends are at stake, your future is at stake, and then your faith is at stake every single time. And you know what? Many of us, we choose to say, oh, that's fine, but. And that but is it, the awareness piece of it says, matter of fact, there's even a quote that says this. I'm not familiar with the person who made it, but Joyce Roberta Burdett says this: alcoholism isn't a spectator sport. Eventually, the whole family gets to play. And the awareness is this. There was a study done that Jack talked about in his interview that was just published just a few years back that talked about how fifth graders were interviewed. Fifth graders were interviewed and asked, you know, why do you drink? And then they asked the parents, why do you think your son or daughter drinks? Well, the parents answered and said, well, because of peer pressure, they probably drink to fit in and all these kind of things. When the fifth graders were asked, why do you drink? They simply said, to get drunk. That's why they wanted to drink. And you know what? If you drink before the age of 14, which, by the way, one out of three people do at one point, then 50% of those people become alcoholics statistically. And there's a reason why there's a law for 21, because it's a physical thing as well as responsibility, because your body can't handle it. And there's a huge gap between parents' awareness and the children's reasoning. And many of the children said, well, I get it from my parents' cabinet or my friend's parents' cabinet. If you're a parent here and alcohol is in your home, I would just say this. I would say, chances are, if your son or daughter are drinking and you know about it, it's from your liquor, and also they're doing it three to four times more than you're aware of it statistically. And I would just be very, very careful about that, about the choices that you make that not only affect you, but other people as well. So not only is it awareness, but also it is accountability. And that's the part that we're talking about. We're talking about that Jesus in himself is the answer, but also other people. And we end at this place every single time where we say, we need to have other people come alongside of us, because in ourselves, we are not strong enough, and other people need to come and do something. Let me tell you a quick story. I remember one time my brother Chuck come home, and he was the oldest brother, and he was drunk, and he was in a white suit. Remember back in the 80s when white suits were popular? And he had my brother Jim, who was one above me. He's number four in line. He had him cornered in the bathroom, and he was just beating on him. Just wailing on him. And Chuck's very, very strong. And Jimmy was screaming, and I was in the living room and looking at this, and I just couldn't do anything about it. And my brother Tom, who's very much smaller, he's number three in line, he's just a skinny little scrawny dude. He was sleeping on the couch. And Chuck's just wailing on Jim, and Jim's just screaming and crying. And all of a sudden, Tom gets up just like that. This is the first time it ever happened in my household. And he ran and he stood in between Chuck and Jim. And it's like the room froze, and Chuck looked at him and he said, get out of my way. Tom said, I'm not moving. And he said, what are you going to do? Hit me? And Tom said, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I do know this. It stops here. He said, you're not going to hit him again. And every time I think about that or even feel, I'm so flooded with emotion because of this. You may be in a situation where you don't even know what to do, but something has to be done. And I would just encourage you to initiate intervention, like Jack said, or start a conversation in the car. And you don't even know how to bring it up. And there are people that don't want to have conversations because it's so tense, which is exactly what Mary and Jean spoke of in their husbands' lives. But I would just encourage you to say, there needs to be some hard conversations. And you may not know what to do, but the one thing you do know is that you're going to walk with them every step of the way, and it'll end here. And that never happened in our family again. Never did they ever come home and do that to us again. Because my brother took a stand and made a choice. So please take action. And then here's the final thing is the word authority. The first one is awareness. The second one is accountability. The third one is authority. Let me just show you a quick verse before we close. John chapter 7, verses 37 and 38. It says, on the last day of the feast, the greatest day, Jesus stood up and shouted, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me, and let the one who believes in me drink." And it's interesting how he uses the word drink here, and he says, just as the scripture says, "For within him will flow rivers of living water." See, here's the deal. Jesus needs to be the final authority. And I tell you without apology that Jesus isn't a answer. Jesus is the answer. And that in our lives, we could probably for a while have control or willpower over maybe a destructive habit. But for some of us, alcohol is the authority. But the problem is most of us bail to our own selves and say, I'm going to be the authority. I'm going to take control. But it is when we decide to let God in through us. See, here's the thing. God is not going to give you the power to beat this thing. God is going to change the craving within you. It'll always be there. Just like a recovering alcoholic, which I know hundreds will always say, hey, I'm a recovering alcoholic for 20 years and I'm still a recovering alcoholic. It will always be there. But here's the deal. Jesus says, if you drink of me, I will change that which you want for your life. And the tipping point is you continue to do these things despite of negative consequences in your life. So I just challenge you to go ahead and do the deal. Jack says, go 30 days. Just decide it. If you don't think it's a problem, try it and then see what comes about. Because we need awareness, yes, but we also need accountability. We need other people, and we need the authority for Jesus to be the authority in our lives. Who is the final authority in your life? And before we pray, I'm going to go ahead and just close with this. One verse that I always had in the Bible was Philippians 4:13. I played football, played baseball most of my life. In every locker room, Philippians 4:13 was always on posters. And it said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And when I was a teenager, you know what I thought? I is the operative word in that verse. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can do it. Until I realized, you know, that I got caught up in doing so much. That the operative word for me in legalistic religion became the word do. I can do all things. I had to do and be good and follow commandments and do and do and do. Until that became so tiresome in my stupid religious hang-up life that I finally learned my lesson and realized the operative word in that verse is the word through. That I can do all things, but only if it's through Jesus Christ who strengthens me. And I'm telling you right now, Jesus is the only one that is going to give you that which fills the void for your destructive habit or behavior. So would you do me a favor? Would you pray with me?